So I was reading in the news this morning that Lucasfilms, the people who made Star Wars and a bunch of other really cool things, decided to replace the Kubernetes rendering, their Docker engine system, with more of an object-oriented system. Working title? Java the Hutt. Hey, 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 okay, okay, hey. These jokes are guaranteed for as long as you'll stay here. There are bad jokes coming. My name is Daniel Markov. This is DanielBMarkov.com. If you've never been here before, you haven't really missed much in your life, but you know, I'm glad that you came by and you're going to have fun today, because what we do on Nerd Roundup is we take the tech news stories of the week, sit back and have fun, and joke around and do some seriously nerdy goofing off. I believe that a team that can relax and have fun with one another can do damn near anything, and the only way I can really show you how to do that is just to do it. So here today we have John Kern. John, good to see you, my friend.
Hello, hello. Happy New Year, right?
It is New Year. It is year three of Nerd Roundup. This is the third year. I did this October of 2019, then all of 2020, 2021. So, yeah, year three. Wow. There's a lot of nerds to be rounding up.
Yeah. They keep scattering.
And we've yet to see the new physics or the holy grail of physics or all the, you know, every week there's like a new solar energy is yet to take over the entire planet. You know, just,
yeah.
All those problems.
Yeah. I still can't, like, fly my car out of the driveway.
You mean, do you really want a? Do you really want a world full of people with flying cars?
No.
No, I do not. I personally, no. These people with the regular car, bad enough. I see the people sleeping in the back with a Tesla driving. Yeah, maybe the whole thing was autopilot, but not.
Yeah, it would have to be. It would be some sort of thing where you push a destination and it inserts you into a queue, and yeah, sounds boring.
It does sound really, really boring. And I had this picture of this sort of quadricopter with like mud flaps with like the little silver girl on the back, some other rifle rack on top, you know.
Yeah, that would be funny.
Yeah, I don't know where that's going to go. I imagine probably a lot of really rich people are going to have them in 10, 20 years.
Yeah, and I can't imagine a fifth-wheel quadcopter and carrying a camper or a horse trailer.
A horse trailer. Wow. Talk about scaring the crap out of the horse. Oh, my God. Yeah, a wreck on I-5 and 12 horses fell from the sky. Thought the turkey thing was bad. Wow. you look a little hoarse yourself there, my friend. You're getting over. You got the flu? Yep. Okay. Okay. So, first thing we do is what we've been doing this week. And since you're catching up, what I've been doing this week, I've been redoing my entire home network because I love network operations. My internet provider has a 5.9s reliability. That means every morning, five of them get around at 9 a.m. and try to discuss on what they fucked up over the previous week and how they can actually get the damn thing working again. Sometimes they get it working, sometimes not. Today they get up at 11:30 or so. So I decided that instead of letting their modem do all the configuration inside my house, that I would just manage my own DHCP server and DNS server and all the things that go along with running your network. I used to do that. I've done that my entire life. But with these guys, they're like, no. You plug up to the wall. This tech stuff will handle this without you. We're good. And what that means in practice is, sometimes stuff works here, sometimes it doesn't, and then my wife asks me what I did to break things, and I know if I did or didn't, so I decide I would rather hold it all here, and then I will determine whether that's working locally, and then I'll just plug the wire in and out to see if they're going to connect me up or not. I don't trust them, basically, what it comes down to. What have you been doing?
Thankfully, not that. although I do need to create some extender of a bit of a mesh network into the stone part of the house. And we're challenged with 2 foot thick walls of stone and then a big chunk of the house that's 1850s brick, you know, and the new modern parts, that's not so hard, but getting coverage is always a challenge, and So yeah, maybe you can come over my.
Yeah, what are you using now for your hardware?
So I bought a system that I think was probably I forget the name of it that I've messed around with but didn't permanently install it. So, but it's the kind of thing where you can have like a central box and then like in a. Maybe I think it probably came out of maybe a hotel that would have had repeater.
The little things systems. That they round little repeaters. You have like little round.
Yeah, stick up yeah, the they're round things, and then there's a main thing that you connect at the modem or whatever, you know, and then route. It's supposed to route it out.
Well, Google so has that wonderful mesh system. Ubiquiti also has a pretty cool mesh system. You can. Buy off the shelf and kind of plug up. Most of those are plug and play until you get into more. You're doing cable modem, right? You've got the cable coming in.
Yeah. 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 And they have, you know, it looks like you can just connect. I tried it once. I just need to do it for real. And the other thing is I got Comcast, you know, is what we've had for a while. And then I also got Fios just for fun, because of especially with an engagement with a client for the past since April, who needed Citrix VDI. So I had to basically, I guess it's like a virtual desktop. So it seemed to really suck, and we theorized that well, there's a lot more upload than normal, and so Comcast cable. Downloads are, you know, massive, like stupid fast, and uploads only what 6 or 5? I mean, something paltry. But Fios was the same up and down. So, nice young man came by many, you know, like a year ago and selling.
Were so you like, what are you up and down? 100-100 or 50-50 or?
On the Fios, yeah, it's like 150 maybe. It's pretty decent. It's fast and. And it made a difference with using the Citrix VDI. It felt better. It's still Citrix VDI sucked, but so now I have two systems, which my wife is not super happy about. So it was bad enough paying Comcast. Now chucking another $80 at Fios.
Well, maybe it's either your Fios or my networking this week. But your video's looking, the quality's looking really, really good today. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's true. Both of ours looks high, like HD. Yeah.
Very cool. Now, of course, we're also using Discord, so who knows? We'll figure this out over time. I used to have satellite, and I hated satellite because it sucked. But the nice thing about satellite was they gave you a modem, and your modem had an IP address. So if you had a problem, you just surfed into your modem, typed it into your web browser, and your modem would tell you what was going on. It would say, you can't find a satellite, and it would talk to you about its connection to the internet, and then if that was working, then the rest of it was your problem. Unfortunately, the parent folks do not seem to find this simplicity something they want to do, and I'm going to kill them all with a bazooka.
Yeah, I haven't done that in a while, but you're right. I do remember in the old days of early cable modems, at least, yeah, you could physically connect to it, the IP address, and get like an admin-type console and do stuff.
Well, you still can, except they just lock they lock you out now. From I guess a lot of people they would rather control all the horizontal and vertical for you, which would be great if it worked fine.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, so this week I had some cool articles. This first one, oh my god. Okay, so this first one is last week Exchange 2019, the mail server that Microsoft makes, had a problem with an update. Okay, and. You guys got to read this to believe it. Basically, what they're saying is that I'll repeat exactly how the long type, blah, 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 for the comment about signed long here. What it's saying is that the long type, long integer, allows for values up to 2147, 483, 647, which is a long integer. So it appears that Microsoft uses the first two numbers of the update version to note the year of the update. So the way they did their updates was to pull off the first two digits of the long integer type to represent the year, and that only goes to 2021. And when it became 2022,
no way.
It's like, who?
Is that just trying to, that's like, instead of the year 2000, let's just make an even weirder one that nobody can guess.
It's like of all of the dipshit stuff you could come up with. I know, okay, what we'll do is we'll do this next and this one, do it in like, and so the guy suggested maybe they could move to unsigned logs, and then you could get to the year 2042, which would make, give them another 20 years for them to fix the whole thing. It's like, fuck.
Yeah, I mean, I could excuse the Y2K thing. Like, you could tell normal people, oh, well, you see, back 30 years ago when they made that decision, storage was really, really expensive. So saving 50% on the date is huge. If you're talking about millions and millions of records, right? You could at least make an excuse when the layperson goes, wait, why is this stuff breaking? Like, what do you mean? But I had no excuse. There's no excuse for anybody who's remotely lived through Y2K or is just a modern programmer to do any monkey business.
Why, like, would you care? Why would you use the int in the first place? And if you use the int, why would you start pulling decimal digits off the other side? It's like,
yeah. Right. It's amazing. I'm sure they thought it was a brilliant idea at the time.
It was, it reminds me of a scene in airport, airplane, toward the end of the guy goes, hey, should we turn on the runway lights? Yeah, guy goes, that's just what they'll be expecting. Of course, the gimmick is you're supposed to turn a light, you're supposed to be kind to these people.
Yeah.
Oh, well, good stuff. So this next one kind of reminds me of a 50s TV show. This is astronomers uncover largest group of rogue planets yet. I have this kind of picture of a bunch of planets wearing leather jackets riding around on motorcycles. Have you heard anything about rogue planets, John? John? Come back, John. John, we're frozen. And you can hear me, and you can't see me. I'm moving around. And now back to weather. John.
Yes.
Hey, okay. Have you heard anything about rogue planets? Do you know what a rogue planet is?
No.
Yeah. Beats up the other planets. Takes us lunch. No, a rogue planet is actually a planet without a star. It's just sort of a planet wandering through the solar system.
And they don't want to call it an asteroid.
Well, it's not through the galaxy, not through the solar system. It's just a big Jupiter running along on its own, doing its own thing. And so they found 70 of this previous year. It's kind of a cool way of the way they found it. You want to read this. But the really interesting question is just how many of these planets without solar systems are there wandering around? And nobody really knows. I've heard estimates that there's 100 of these to everyone in a system. I've heard us. We don't know because they're so difficult to find.
Yeah. They're pretty small, the scale of things.
Very, very small. And, you know, we can't do the star wobble thing or the occultation thing we do. The way they did this one was they actually looked for newly forming planets that were hot. So they used infrared sensors, and they used an area very close to our own solar system. So who knows? This is going to be wild. If it turns out there's more planets not in solar systems than there are, that's going to be kind of a strange. Astronomy is going to change quite a bit.
Yeah, that breaks a lot of mental models.
It does. It does. A lot of the stuff, you know, even going back to the old sci-fi Star Trek and get Battlestar Galactica and all the things, typically they go from system to system visiting planets. Well, if there are 100 times more planets outside of systems, you know, the system would be the weird thing to visit. It's just strange. This next one, a really cool article, is that companies that had successful pivots. Have you heard about how startups do what's called a pivot? That's a big thing the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
You start off in one direction, you end up going a different direction. This guy made a list on GitHub of all these companies that started off and what their initial plan was and how they ended up. Like YouTube was actually started off as a dating platform. And once they couldn't even pay women to $20 to upload a video of themselves, you know, wanting a date, then they decided they'd just go to videos in general. So
that's fun.
Yeah, some interesting stories here. What was it? Shopify, big e-commerce platform, started off selling snowboard equipment online. Yeah, you want a bunch of cool stories, this is the place to go. Included the Hacker News discussion link, because that was like way cool too. They talk about Nintendo and some of the other companies these people have actually worked with and kind of was with them during the pivot, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of fascinating things to be learned from reading stuff like this. Or, you know, I was just talking with our one daughter about setting up a business and testing business model ideas, and you know, things don't have to be as in place as you might always think. And I asked her if she'd heard about the Zappos story, and she had. You know, like that's a, because that's a classic one too, where you just make it look like you've got infrastructure and back end, and the meanwhile, no, it's a guy who's just trying out an idea and goes and gets stuff and, you know, does it all himself. And, you know, I didn't need to build a whole server to test out the, you know, and those sorts of ideas, you know, the crazy things that happen during pivots, you know, it's it helps to remind me anyway that treat things like a hypothesis, test them. Don't, you know, they're not always, your ideas might not always be right. And it's through testing and exploring, you stumble in potentially new and profitable crazy things. So yeah, it's cool stuff.
We talked about this last week about sort of how when you learn to program, you start thinking of terms and things of Booleans or integers or whatever. Then you kind of realize that, wait a minute, real life doesn't work in sprints. Real life isn't sort of yes and no as much as you'd like for it to be. It's a difficult thing to keep in your head at the same time you're trying to, like, debug something.
Yeah. It is a challenge to be in the thing and yet try to be able to be outside of the thing. Yeah.
My favorite phrase when dealing with TED is you can't have technical debt on code that has no economic value. And the point being is that unless you have an economic theory that you're actually proved out that works, it's generating income, your code by definition is worthless. So there's no, you will never refactor it. You will never, you're nowhere near reality. Fowler's idea was, you know, the code model, the code reflects the model, the problem domain. Well, if you don't have an economic engine, you got no freaking problem domain. You have nothing to refactor. There's nothing here that works. So I think we forget the business test. Outside of the V, business test comes before everything else. That's got to be the driver.
Yep.
Good stuff. Now, this is the story about Nintendo. I don't know if you remember that Nintendo was actually a trading card, like a card company for many, many years. And this guy got he inherited from his grandfather's. He comes to the United States, maybe 50s or 60s, visits a trading card company here in the U.S. And it's got like a couple offices and kind of a shack somewhere. He said, you know, we can't keep doing great trading cards. There's just no money in this thing. And so they're just big lists of things that they started doing. What was it? A taxi service, love hotels, rice. There's a whole bunch, some great stories here. Yeah. Enron, the guys who stole all the money, were going to do streaming movies over the internet. Sound familiar? Yeah. The infrastructure was not there to support streaming. But it turned out that the infrastructure was there to support stealing a lot of money. So that kind of worked out well for them, really, until they got caught.
Yeah.
What was it? Somebody said they went to a meeting at Enron, and at the end of the meeting, one guy looks at him and he says, do you have any idea at all what these people are doing? And the guy's like, no, but it looks like they're pretty smart, though. It's
like, yeah. For a while.
Anyway. Smartest guy, I think that was the name of the book, Smartest Guys in the Room. Sure. This is a really cool little kind of slice of trivia article here, programming 1987 versus today. And the guy talks about programming what was called a COCO, what's a TRS-80 color computer, COCO. This was beloved by many programmers. I didn't have one myself because those fancy color computers were like extra, but
they're often called the Trash 80.
The Trash 80. Oh my God. Yeah. And I was there when the big clunker came out at Radio Shack. I mean, I was like 13 or something. I was there almost, I want to say every night, but at least three nights a week because they had a real working computer that you could like put a cassette in and play games and type in your own programs. I was, wow, good time. I did a guessing game in BASIC. So my big thing when I was a kid was we had paper routes. I made money on paper routes. Then we had the video arcade.
Yep.
And next to the video arcade was the Radio Shack. So it's like Nirvana.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember I used to go to them a lot.
That was fun stuff.
And I did Heathkit.
Oh, whoa, you did the Heathkit with the soldering iron and all that? Wow. Wow, this is like the new freezing is just freezing. Like, there, John. That's so weird. So he said, continuing the story. Down here, if you guys are interested in old-timey programming, here we have, this is a basic machine language, basic/ machine language piece of code down here. The way we did that, look here, so we've got this line item 5, it's clear, 25, 12,000 reserve memory. Line item 10 is deaf user. There you are, John. I'm just doing this walkthrough here real quick. This is how you programmed in BASIC and machine language at the same time back in the day. You did a clear, you reserved a memory here. You defined the user. This defines a variable name to a value. So actually kind of, you're setting a register is what you're doing, I believe, at this point. So then he does a for next to go through the code to store each byte of the code. And here's your code down here. So you typed your code in as numbers, ASCII numbers. These guys would have been right at home with the versioning folks on the Microsoft Exchange server.
That's meta.
And then so Polk, this is so bizarre to explain this to people. So what Polk did, Polk actually stuck things in physically directly into the computer memory. And so big hunk of code here that you've actually worked out the numbers to, and then you stick some stuff into the right spot, and then you call the subroutine here. And I've ran code very, very similar to this myself many, many a time. And so that's how you get the high performance, really kick-ass stuff out of BASIC. Yeah.
Nice and debuggable.
Well, yeah, just I think the data thing would blow people's minds the most. It's like, okay, well, here's your program right here. It's like, why? It's like, yeah, of course.
Exactly.
And if I remember right, we would end up, you'd write it in columns, and then you'd break out the 6502 instruction set so you could tell what the code did, and then you would put the decimals in. Because, you know, some of this might be load A, then you'd have the value for A, and this is the whole thing, my friends, the whole thing. There's nothing missing here. That's crazy.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is pretty wild. Then here, this guy, here, what would it take today? And it looks like he's doing this. What have you got here? What is this? A Perl. Doing it in Perl. I'm not a Perl master by any means, but it looks, reads almost like English. Do you remember your first experience with programming, you could actually have variable names? Because I remember that was a big deal for me. I was like warp drive.
Yeah, I think my exposure was my brother one year came home from, we lived in Pennsylvania by this time. He was still, at Ohio State or, but I remember a Sinclair computer. And there was some programming thing on it for BASIC, and I all I did was create some print statements and things like that, and I drew a Christmas tree in ASCII text with like presents under it. That's my only vague. So I'm gonna guess there was probably no variables.
Well, when it started, this TRS-80 stuff you can see here, like, you know, he's got for I equals 1 to 28, read B, read I. It's all just, I think it did two letter variables. I'm not sure it went to three, but I think maybe it did two letters. But you couldn't actually put a variable name in there.
Interesting. Yeah.
Microsoft BASIC. I think it was the Amiga, maybe. I load that rascal up. It had 32 character variable names, upper and lower case. It was like,
yeah, I remember something like GW BASIC. Does that sound familiar?
GW was the DOS BASIC, I think.
Okay, yeah, maybe. Yeah.
I'm not sure what the rules were. It may have, I think it was stolen by Microsoft, so it may have had longer variable names.
Yeah, probably.
They back then, they stole it as much as they get away with. They stole quite a bit of stuff. Okay. I don't know if this is going to come up or not. It's not going to come up. The title of this article in The Atlantic, and it's on the link, is "You Have No Idea How Much It Takes to Get a Hamster Drunk."
True statement.
It is a true statement. I was not aware of this. You would think elephants would be the big drinkers, you know, big elephant. They're language. Hamsters, almost impossible to get drunk. You can't get it. And the reason why is because they're little rodents who have lived on rotted fruits for so long that their livers are just kick butt at processing alcohol. The guy said you could put like a cup of Everclear next to the hamster. Hamster be fine. As fast as the hamster drinks it, his liver converts it into fuel. It's impossible. Now, they tried injecting the hamster with alcohol. Then they got some damn drunk hamsters at that point. But somebody gets paid for this. I don't.
Yeah, that's exactly. Like, where are we? Yeah. Where was this? Yeah.
Yeah, well, this guy did it. He had his, as I understand the article, he had a hamster growing up that he, I guess, went out drinking with. Maybe the hamster drove. I don't know. What
time. I was going to say, designated driver. Hamster driver.
That's fine.
Which way should I turn?
Yeah, he's a hamster. He just can't get drunk. Okay, he's had more than I had, but he's fine. Tough sell. Yeah. So it turns out if you're out ever go out drinking with a hamster, or if you really want to try to get a hamster drunk, you'll fail. You will fail every time.
He'll drink you out of the table.
Yeah, that's a good bar bet to have if you have a hamster with you.
Yeah. He'll drink you under the cedar shavings.
Yeah. You don't want to buy drinks for like a room full of hamsters.
No.
That's right. I can honestly say I've never done that, and I would never do it.
Yeah.
NASA hired 24 theologians to study human reaction to aliens. I'm thinking would be probably the best reaction. Yeah, it's kind of a weird book. NASA's been paying theologians to explain back to NASA how we would handle meeting aliens. I've heard this my entire life, that somehow Western religions are incapable of handling intelligences. I've yet to believe it. I think it's just sort of another way of saying redneck people are stupid. But I guess if you're a theologian, it's good money to be made working for NASA.
I don't know.
Yeah, man, you could tell them what to say when we meet aliens.
Yeah.
Eric Weinstein last week had a tweet. He was like, okay, let's say just for a thought experiment that we today, I think it was like a Tuesday, we prove for sure that there are other intelligent civilizations in the universe. What happens on Wednesday? And my answer was not really much anything. It's just, I really don't see it being sort of the end of anything or a big change up or anything. I just think life kind of goes on the way it's always been going.
Yeah. It's hard to predict the unknown. I know, isn't it Stephen Hawking's? It was like, yeah, no, I wouldn't be broadcasting our location. Anybody who can get it and do something about it is probably going to come and, you know, conquer you. Yeah.
And I think probably even sadder is the fact that we've got these examples of our own civilizations mixing over the years with some horrible things, really horrible, horrible things happen. And so no matter what you could make up, we've already done that. We've ate people we've conquered. We've made enslaved them. You know, there's nothing really that, unless I control your brains or something, it's we've done so many horrible things where we have a sort of genre of, okay, these are like Mongols that eat people or whatever. We're not going to do.
Right. Yeah, we're a pretty violent sort of creature, you know. Well, most nature is. So it's eat or be eaten, and we're only mildly above that.
I worry that my concern would not be religion or cruelness. I think you've got a good point about keeping things quiet. My concern would be assuming the best, which I think is a long shot. They show up and they're nice people. Even then, how are you going to keep our culture? Because these are going to be an advanced civilization. They're spacefaring. We're going to be like the, you know, Peru Indians, meaning the Spanish. It's
yeah, or those the folks down in like the Amazon, those who shoot bow and arrows, like the pygmy tribe or whatever, they shoot bow and arrows at the helicopter that was photographing them. You know, and they're like, they haven't seen civilization or, yeah, something like that. That's just
cargo cult
so
people.
Far apart. Yeah. It's crazy.
Where they built the, remember the cargo cult people on the native islands in the Pacific? They built little wooden airplanes because they felt like the airplanes was what made the Westerners come bring the money. So they built little idolatrous airplanes and such to try to bring back more Westerners. If you really want to know, and people say, well, you know, the Fermi paradox is why aren't we aware of civilizations? You know, why isn't a foot fungus aware of a civilization? You know, if you are a spacefaring civilization, you probably don't have very much to say to us. We're probably not that very interesting. Now that there are hamsters, however, boy, you take those guys out, they'll have a blast with those fellas, but not us.
Yeah.
This next one's probably the most nerdiest one we got this week. Is there's a new statistical method. It's been around since the 90s, but they keep honing, called the fragility index, and it's a way of actually double measuring scientific studies to see if they've been p-hacked or not. Good stuff.
Oh. Yeah. Because that is a classic.
Yeah. If you tortured the data enough, it will confess to anything.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the like the Pfizer vaccine tests. They disbanded the control arm.
I didn't hear that.
Just about the time that the data starts to show waning efficacy, right? And I'm just going to go out on a limb saying Pfizer isn't stupid. They're some of the best at designing trials to get the results they want. So that wasn't accidental. You know, it's a far-fetched to think that they, you know, abandoned the control arm on, you know, just an oops.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Somebody was said that the, and I like this idea in theory, I haven't kicked around too much, but the FDA currently is responsible for both efficacy and safety of new medicines, that maybe they should just pick one of those. And I think they recommended safety. If the thing's safe, then just publish all the efficacy data and let the public sort it out. Because by making the bar so high, then you know, the company's playing games like this to try to get
there. Yeah, right. It's like, yeah, even like Dr. Malone was talking about some Defense Department work they're doing on a pretty promising vaccine that had included hydroxychloroquine in it. But, and this is a Defense Department type, you know, a government agency with government agency, aka the FDA. Well, it was such a rigmarole just because that was included as part of the protocol.
Yeah.
That even the Defense Department said, all right, screw it. That's just, I'm tired of fighting with our own damn, you know, FDA. We'll just drop that, even though it was the data was better with it. We'll drop it and move ahead without it. But yeah, you're right. It causes, you know, those sorts of games to be played, or like, all right, you know, it's just, you make the hill too high to climb, even though it might have been the right thing to do.
And they try to, you know, every time there's some problem, they try to like reorganize the plumbing so that the problem will never occur again. And you end up with really complex plumbing. You end up with people who get paid full time to understand how it works. And also you end up with this bullshit where it's like, okay, well, right, something politically is unacceptable. So really that plumbing stuff doesn't matter because there's no way we're going to go this way, whether it works or not. It's like, well, then you've lost complete track of what the hell you're supposed to be doing here.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a sad thing. I think FDA should go with safety because efficacy is something we can all look at. And plus, you know, if you look it back, except for the vaccine discussion, we've seen drug companies come out with like a 5% improvement maybe in depression and then sell the hell out of that thing for like 10 years and then maybe another 5% in statins or whatever. And so the drug companies, like you said, are not stupid. They're playing the incremental game because that's what the machine set up for them to do, and they're moving that thing for billions.
Yeah, exactly. Don't want to solve all the problems too quickly.
No, and I tell you, I hate to sound like a futurist. I don't believe that Elvis flies a UFO, but I am seeing some interesting stuff with psychedelics and depression, especially. What is it, ketamine, which has been around for 60, 70 years. They can do a low-dose ketamine for suicidal patients such that the patient doesn't even feel as if they're having any psychedelic and relieves suicide ideation for weeks or months later. It's just freaking, wow. Yeah, freaking, it's amazing stuff. And it's open, it's off the market. I mean, you can, anybody can use it. It's being used in surgery now. So we're seeing some cool stuff, but we wouldn't have saw that had the system continued to sort of get more and more complex.
Yeah. Be back in a sec.
Okay. So I will continue this next story, which blows my freaking mind, my friends. Sometimes you read stupid stories and you're like, hey, how can things be this idiotic? And this is one of these guys here. I don't know where to start this thing. So the headline here is, it's from the 1 mile at a time blog. The headline is Emirates probably terrifying Boeing 777 flight to Washington. And the way, what happened here, brand new Boeing 7770 and 777, the United Emirates. I think they were in Dubai, yes, and they were going to Dulles. A few weeks ago, December 20th. I'm going to try to describe what happened in a way that does not make me just sort of yell at people. The pilots got into this beautiful $50-100 million airplane. They did not do at least two different checklists. They did not reset the flight director for the desired altitude, for one thing, which is, I mean, if you're, once you take off, you're usually given climb to 3,000, 4,000 feet at a vector to a VOR. That's called departure instructions. But they did not program the computer of where to climb to, where to go, which, okay, their pilots, they should be able to fly the plane. But once they started down the runway, since the computer was not told where to fly or how high, it just kept telling them to go straight, and dang it, if they just didn't keep going straight and went about 120 miles per hour faster than they should have on the runway. And I wonder if they'd flown the damn thing like into the trees had they kept going. They finally, I guess, based on the fact somebody said, hey, maybe we should be, you know, leaving the ground now, finally pulled up, missing local houses by 50, 60 feet. I don't know, as a passenger, if I were not a pilot, would I notice this or not, but it is a freaky, scary thing. It boggles the mind that you'd be put in charge of a plane like this and not do, like I said, at least two checklists were missed that would have fixed this. And if you missed the two checklists, you're in VFR conditions, you're looking out the window, it's a sunny day, and you're going down the runway, you should know how to make the plane go up in the air. So these pilots actually misprogrammed their computer, almost drove the plane like off the airport into the subdivision before one of them decided to actually pull up. I don't think Moron really describes, this is like multiple failures of stuff. That's crazy, John. It's these guys were going 260 knots and they were just coming off right here. And then normally by 260 knots, God, they're probably 4,000 feet or so. So they just kept going straight. They just, because the flight director did not tell them to pull up because they had not programmed the stupid flight director, they would follow that damn computer, I guess, about near anywhere. Yeah.
That's scary.
That's really fucked up. I can think of once, I used to read a lot of aviation safety magazine. There was a pilot, co-pilot, each of them had several thousand hours in a, I think it was a Lear or a Citation, a business jet, flew into the side of a mountain on a clear day because they were futzing around with a stupid computer instead of flying the damn plane. So it's not unheard of, but I mean, two pilots in a commercial airline, yeah. I mean, okay, I could see maybe flying in the mountain if you took off and looks okay and you're not paying attention, but you should be looking out the window when the plane is going to take off. That's I think a sort of negotiable thing for pilots. It's just so weird.
It's quite a nice option to use, you know, like driving. It's good to look out the window. Yeah. Yeah, it's while you're supposed to trust your instruments, maybe you shouldn't trust your computer.
Yeah, you trust but verify. You trust and cross-check.
Yeah.
I had to do this, the books I've been doing was how to make stuff people want, how to make the right thing. And I had to do examples, and I wanted to put software examples in. The best examples I came up with were aviation examples, because in aviation, we build these really complex, really cool pieces of tech, and sometimes they work really cool and sometimes not. And it's not necessarily because of a bug somewhere. It's just the way humans interact with the tech isn't always evident.
And
Did you read about what was it, Air France 447 a few years back? It was the flight over the Pacific, I think, that crashed. I think they iced out in a thunderstorm and crashed into the ocean.
no, I didn't read about that one. No.
They iced the pitot tubes of the plane. It was at night. The pilot, the captain, the most hours had went to sleep, and the pitot tubes iced up, so the airspeed indication was off.
Yep.
And they thought they were falling. So they firewalling the throttle and pulling it way back. And they ended up getting the plane almost like this. I mean, like 50, 60 degrees at takeoff power. And they were just falling. So this is 35,000 feet. The pilot gets up. He's like, what the hell's going on? And here you are coming in from a dead sleep trying to figure out what is the airplane doing? This should be part of the acceptance test for the software. And of course, they all died. It was a very sad thing.
Yeah, so that's a real unusual attitude test, which I always enjoyed when my instructor would put me through those. Those are some of my favorite things of, okay, now recover, under the hood, and they, mess up your vestibular system, and that's what I, what I meant, like trust your instruments when you can't see out, yeah, and you're all disoriented because your head's all spinning and things are all wacky,
Yeah, it's the
yeah.
old saying, is power plus pitch equals performance. So the way you would do this in a normal plane without all the bells and whistles is you'd come out, what's the power setting, what's the pitch of the plane, and then you would start checking your airspeed and all that. But they were programmed, the computer was programmed to use the airspeed indicator, which then messed up everything else. And interests were telling them conflicting things, and they couldn't do the debugging. They died debugging the damn airplane.
Yeah, it's surprising.
Yeah, it's, I'm not. I was quite unhappy about that one. And this Emirates plane is, oh my God! And these people are supposed to have pretty high, qualifications. Fly 777G.
Yeah, that and the, the 680s. Yeah, that's kind of crazy.
What people don't realize, and I've known have free several airline friends. I have a few that are Czech pilots. If you're not careful, it becomes almost like driving a Greyhound bus. You
Sure.
just it's a checklist. Everything's a checklist. Everything's computerized, and it's. I'm not so sure that we're actually made things simpler on people by making things simple on people, if that makes any sense.
Well, the risk is you only need the pilot when you need them. And when you need them, the shit's hitting the fan. Yeah, it is fascinating. I always love the reports and reading about what sometimes things are narrowly avoided. Those are like nice stories, but yeah, it's almost always pilot error.
Well, and the thing that I think what maybe people don't realize, and of course, a turbofan engine is a very complex piece of gear, but aviation itself, you got you're pushed being pushed through the air, and you get the Bernoulli principle, debatable over the wings, and you got three different control surfaces you're flying. It's not we did this 120 years ago. It's not a horribly complex thing. We can make it really complex if we wanna, but it doesn't have to be.
No, it's 6 degrees of freedom. It's easier than sailing. I know when we were modeling, I did some modeling for boats and things like that. That's fairly complex. Airplanes are really simple. Cars on the ground, more complex.
Yes.
Just because there's, when you're up in the air, you're all by yourself. It really is. You don't have the ground force. You don't have a keel. You don't have water. You don't have the wind on the sail. You just got the airplane doing its thing. So it is, in some sense, a fairly Like I said, 6 degrees of freedom. It's a pretty simple model.
You might consider it to be sort of three-dimensional surfing through the wind if you want to make it more complex. You know, I think one of the examples I bring up with my wife from time to time, we'll see these ski points. They land on top of a glacier on a mountain.
Yeah.
And she asked me sometimes, she's like, well, you know, how can you take off when it's not flat? Like, it doesn't you can just sail right off the cliff. It doesn't really matter. If you're falling through the air, as long as you've got enough space to pick up the airspeed, you're fine. It's not... It may be a little more exciting than you would like,
right? Yeah.
But I mean, you know, you don't need a magic thing. The plane flies without the engine just fine.
Yeah, it's like those guys who run off the, you know, I remember watching him in Switzerland. There's this one the Salève outside of Geneva. These cliffs, and the dudes with the, you know, like the hang gliders, whatever you call them, you know. Yeah, the first time I'm sure it's scary as hell, but you're watching, they didn't die, so it must work. But yeah, it's like you run a little bit and get off, and as long as you have enough room to keep going. We used to have even not far from where we live here, there was even a shallow hill. Now it was bought by some, you know, phone company, built a technology campus, but that used to be a little place where hang glider people would just, you know, run down the hill a little bit and get up in the air, and you could go, you know, a couple hundred yards and whoop. Yeah, yeah. Same principle.
Yeah, it is. I've always wanted to fly a glider because, first of all, you can fly a glider if you can fly a regular plane, but because your wings are so huge, you have to get a very, very nice, delicate touch to how they want the plane to behave because you've got so much control surface you're working with. But yeah, it's not something that requires, you know, like a master's degree in as a double E or something to fly a plane. It's a simple process.
I learned when I was 16. Yeah. Taking off's easy. Landing's a little harder.
Well, there's always a landing after every takeoff. Is the thing. It's
yeah.
You never have one without the other. You end up. You come. Right. Goes. I'm soloed, I was like, yeah. The guy. He said, look. He said, this will be fine. He said, I know you're gonna land just fine. The second time, we don't know. But the first time, you're gonna come down.
Yeah.
I'll never forget, John. It was like, wow. It's like it's better than sex. I was at the end of the runway, and I hit that throttle, and a little groundhog ran out in front of the airplane. And the plane's accelerating, this little gopher's out like this, and I'm like, dude, it's me or you, and it's you, because it's not going to be, you're going down, buddy. And somehow he made his way off, and I went up and just went through the motions, and I was extremely nervous being the first time around, but it was, you know, if it were really, really difficult, you couldn't solo with, you know, 10 or 20 hours of training. You'd have to take a, you know, college class or something.
Right. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And the difference with a glider, of course, is you've got to get really good at energy management because yes. you don't get a second shot.
That's what I really love. I did the airbags training and we did a lot of power off landings, and both of those have in common that you have to manage the oomph, you know? So if you're doing like a hammerhead, you're going up, and at some point you've lost your tail authority. First you lose your ailerons, then you lose your tail authority at the end. And at that last little speck, you hit the rudder and bump it about, do what they call a humpty bump, bump it back over to like this, or you can slide back and do the whole hammerhead. But you have to, in your mind, you have to know kind of how much momentum you're carrying with the airplane. It is a fun experience, and the reason I never wanted to be a commercial pilot is because you take all this beautiful, fun experience, and you turn just like a... You know, you wear a suit every day. You got to do a checklist for everything you do. They treat you like crap.
Yeah, you have to do those really hard crosswind landings. You know, you have to crab into the wind and then kick it at the last. Yeah, that's. No, I want the awkward landing where it's one wheel and I can see the damn runway.
I can do that. Yeah, all of it. I used to get scared.
It's just, most of the passengers don't want that one wheel, you know, landing. It's not comfortable for the passengers.
So we'd be coming in like this. I'd say, yeah, you can see the runway right down here.
But even watching some of those videos of, you know, like, you know, Dreamliner, some of those crazy crosswind landings, it's amazing. The, you know, they can do like a 30-degree off-axis landing.
The little plane, come on, you're like 400 pounds. So, you know, you're okay. The tires, but those big planes, you're coming out hundreds of tons like that.
Amazing. Yeah, what they're built to tolerate. Same thing with carrier landings. I remember I was thinking about working at Pax River, and they're showing me some videos of how they do testing of off, you know, like if you track the wire off axis and it's just yanking the plane, you know, that same thing. You're slamming that thing on the deck and it's pulling it sideways and the shear loading. And that's why the dang landing gears on these aircraft are so beefy, is to be able to tolerate the not normal landing.
So I was, you know, my wife had a reunion 10 or 15 years back, and one of her people she went to school with was a fighter pilot in the Navy. And so I was like, oh, you know, go on, I gotta ask him questions. And I was having a couple drinks talking. He said, you know, I said, what was it like? What was it like landing on a carrier at night in a storm, blah, blah, blah. He said, it scared the living shit out of me. He was like, he said, I would leave the plane. He said, I would be just shaking because I was so nervous having to land that plane. I was like, okay.
All that adrenaline. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. At Sea State 5 at night, trying to track the ball. You know, you're running low on fuel state.
Yeah, and I think it, you get think they back, like Armstrong and Glenn and all those guys were doing that with less tech.
Yeah. Well, they still use the same tech almost, the meatball, right? I mean, it's not that much different. Yeah.
It's like the VASI on an airplane.
Yeah, it's like the VASI, right. Yeah.
Similar. Armstrong or Glenn, one was saying that they got lost over the Mediterranean at night. They couldn't find their stupid carrier. I'm not sure how that would happen. But he said he saw the glow in the ocean of where the carrier had stirred up all of this bacteria, phototonic.
The biophosphorus, yeah.
And he just turned that way, and then there was the carrier lights over the horizon.
Wow, they turned the lights on for him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, they turned the lights on. You know, the talking about crosswind landings, the other story was that the B-52 has 60 degrees of canter on its landing gear, I think, so it can actually kind of point this way, the wheels pointed that way, and just come down.
That's helpful. Yeah, they can actually steer them. Yeah, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Cool stuff.
I saw a B-52 take off over me, like at Wright Patterson, probably like in ninth grade. Coolest thing ever.
Oh yeah.
I was probably doing a water ingestion, and just, you know, maybe at most 1,000 feet overhead. It was like the dinosaurs were walking on the earth. It was shaking. You know, I was in awe. We were there for the Wright-Patterson Air Force Museum, you know, and it was like, oh, this is so freaking cool to see him.
My friend was a giant. My friend was a bomb tech at Seymour Johnson, B-52s. And so I got to see one up close, which was, I didn't get to fly in one, but it was like a city. It's like a city. Yeah. A city.
They're massive, yeah.
Frick, wow, it's an amazing plane.
Yeah.
We watched Twilight's Last Gleaming this past week, which is a HBO movie from mid-80s. So nuclear war ravages the world, but it has B-52s in it. So if you like those, you're good. That part's good.
Oh, that's what's the other movie with the B-58 Hustlers? That's a great
one. Oh, you're thinking of Dr. Strangelove, maybe?
Maybe. Yeah, is it that? Something like that.
Some big ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, where were we?
We're here at all the giant tech companies used FFmpeg. This is John Carmack, the guy who was one of the big guys on Doom. He's since been working for Apple. Says, you know, it's kind of weird because I started working at Apple and other companies and found out that they're using this open source audio video processing software. And it is an amazing piece of tech that we've created for free that everybody's using now. It's kind of cool stuff.
Yeah, you use it, right? Isn't that part of your post-processing?
James and I, that's one of the reasons it caught my eye. James and I are both using it. You can, what did somebody said? You could, if you can give me a shoe, I can turn it into a video file. Yeah, it'll do dang near anything.
Funny.
Yeah, this next one, God, this one didn't come up either. This is a pet project of mine, has been for some time. Let's see if I can bring up the live page. This is how to design a house for 1,000 years, and I have, I don't know, it's just been something I've thought about for a long time. It's like, how would you build a structure, in my mind, 10,000 years, but this guy did the 1,000-year version. And it's a whole bunch of questions about erosion, earthquakes, floods, exactly how would you go through doing that. And it was a big discussion, it's a 3-part article, big discussion, a bunch of nerds. Do you want a rigid system that's more vulnerable for earthquakes? Do you want stainless steel? It's if you like construction and you like, you know, mental experiments, this is a fun thing to follow.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say it's impressive. I remember as a young man, and my first trip overseas, and we're in, I don't know, some place in Switzerland. For some reason I want to say Kandersteg. And I remember we're walking, my buddy and I, you know, we're dropped, you know, we skipped the last 2 weeks of high school, so we're going probably to a restaurant, and I look up at a house, and there's people in there eating, and I see the date on the house is 1555.
Gee.
And I'm like, huh, that's cool. it's like a freaking, you know, 500-year-old house almost. That there's still, I'm pretty sure it'll be there in another 500 years. I mean, it's not. So, yeah, I don't know. I think they've solved it.
Well, I guess it depends on where it's going to be. And that's why I always thought my experiment was 10,000 years, because at that kind of time frame, you're looking for earthquakes. So you get all kinds of weird stuff happens, the major floods.
Yeah, 10,000, it's, yeah. There's all sorts of other opportunities for turning something into dust.
Yeah, I've always taken it as far, you know, it seems like you, to me at least, you'd want some sort of stone lean-to. If you could build like a huge lean-to with a sloped roof, stone wall, stone top, that's not going to go anywhere. But of course, then you've got like, how do you do doors, water? You just can't have a big, that's just a cave, a big hunk of rock.
That's just a shelter, yeah. Yeah.
So one of the hackers on Hacker News said, hey, no, what you need to do is use wood for 1,000 years. I'm like, wood? He's like, yeah, wood's flexible. You want something, this guy's all wrong because he's using stainless steel and his structure's too rigid. And then there's getting a big discussion over whether or not he's actually too rigid a structure. And there's like, oh, to give you an idea of what we talk about here, okay? So when this discussion, here we go. This guy talks about the number of microns per year.
Yeah.
Means that 200 microns of rust per year in very aggressive soil. So there's an actual number you can look at depending on what your soil is like that will compute how long your steel will last.
Yeah, do that.
So yeah, he's saying using some sort of ash-based concrete and use regular steel with wooden posts at the top. Well, hell if I know. It's the more you kick at this project, the problem actually the more interesting it becomes. How would you do power generation? You know, what would you do as far as sewage? Fun stuff. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not qualified to weigh in on any of it. That's why I like watching the guys fuss about it, because it's interesting.
Yeah, it's funny to basically, it's often not a bad technique for lots of design discussions is to, or for lots of mental models is to like peg the model, you know, just like take it to an extreme and then see what's going on. So yeah, it's I'm sure it leads to fascinating, you know, crazy discussions around all kinds of topics. Yeah.
One of the things we miss in public discussion, and it's very important because our country is founded on the premise that it's possible to watch really educated people have a discussion and not understand the details, but understand how the discussion's going. So, you know, we have jury trials because 12 random people can be educated by people who disagree and make a decision as far as how those arguments work together without having to be as smart as both lawyers put together. That's the way the court system works. That's the way we're supposed to work as citizens. I think a lot of people have forgotten that. That's a good
point. Yeah, we don't have to be a subject matter expert in what the particular aspect of the case is. We have to be able to consume the two sides, so to speak.
Yeah. It's what I see so many times is that at first people will say, well, okay, it's just a bunch of smart people arguing. I'm too stupid. I will refuse to engage in any of it. And then the second level is, well, he won. Because, you know, he's a better speaker, he's got my side or whatever. The third level is like, okay, I understand what both these people are saying. Here are some points about these generic type of arguments that hold true no matter what the details are. And then you can actually start sort of evaluating the discussion at that point.
Yeah.
I have to bring this up before we go. This is something I wrote this previous week, kind of interesting to me at least. It's called cross-checking. A guy came on the F-Sharp forum and said, hey, what are some good examples of project structures? And I'm like, to do what? He's like, to do projects. I'm like, well, What kind of
You
project?
mean like literally a project management project?
Yeah, I'm like, you're building a website? Are you doing an
Right.
application for like an iOS app?
Yeah.
Or you...
Trying to make Microsoft project? Yeah.
He's like, well, you know, I know how to do programming in F Sharp. I just want to know how to put them together into the code together into projects and folders. Right. Well, what? But if you can't tell me, what? If you can tell me what you want to do, I can give you some examples. I said, if you're trying to learn how to use a certain tech, like a cross compiler to the web or whatever, hey, go find the people who made that tech, and they probably got some wonderful examples for you there.
Yeah, it's a, you know, similar to, I guess, maybe if I looked at software product projects over the course of my career from, let's say, the 80s onward, they started, you know, there's a lot of similarities. But yeah, it is kind of a funny question, because I would think,
it's like, is this a good database? It's like, well, for what? Unless you, I mean, what does the database just sit there and do nothing? Well, it's a great database, no matter what it is. Is it, you know, run your enterprise data lake? Well, okay, let's talk about consumers of that data lake. You got to have a reason d'etre, right, for the whatever you're kind of.
Yeah, I mean, my normal generic answer might be, all right, well, I'm going to use a layered approach, and I'm going to want to be able to see things that are clearly my problem domain. I'm going to want to see things that might be the user interface and maybe the persistence, maybe some systems integration. Like, I might have a generic answer to that if you're talking about building a solution that's like a classic software. Piece
yes.
of software, but yeah,
and this is why I got into my rant, because it was like, okay,
yeah.
So if you he was a C# programmer for 14 years, he was learning F#, he was asking what a good folder structure is, and I know that your answer just now would be kind of the answer. You have entities, it may be an MVC type thing, or you've got some tech and a tiered thing. I mean, this is, you know, bread and butter, apple pie, and I know that would be the answer, but I also know that if he wants to learn how to look at problems from a different perspective besides model view controller, he has to start in a different spot. Okay, so it was like, okay, well, you know, if you're trying to solve a business problem, can you solve the problem by itself? Then can you bolt in your tech off on top of that? If you're doing a tech framework, we'll start with the framework. I said, but if you're learning, it's a different thing than if you're trying to actually solve a business problem. And so I got in this rant over, like, whatever you're doing, whether it's enterprise process design, whether it's designing a method using TDD, whether it's going at a fresh project, you should have some simple idea of what test the dang thing has to pass in your mind, or more specifically in code, and then make it pass that test, even if you don't use that solution, even if later on you bolt it into something else. But that's a good cross-check to determine, hey, it took me 10 minutes to solve this problem using blah, blah, blah. If I take 20 years doing the same solution, one of these things is not, you know, like the other. One is too big. So the whole thing's on cross-checking.
Yeah, which sounds like a hockey article.
Yeah. What's the simplest possible answer? Okay, fine. Now do whatever. I don't care what. I don't really care what tools you use or how you do it, but do you know the difference between the simplest possible answer and what you're planning to do? Because unless you know the answer to that question, you'll never know if you're just wandering far afield into reinventing, you know, Boolean logic or something.
Yeah, and it also struck me as an odd question, especially knowing that the dude did C# forever, whatever. So it's not like a, you know, some brand new newbie to development, not knowing where to start. Like, ooh, I picked up this language and it's kind of cool, but how do I do something other than, you know, a little toy tutorial? You know, and I was thinking it was something along those lines, and still like, all right, wait, why? Like, how can this be? I've never looked at F#. I don't know from Adam, but I guess it'd be like saying, hey, how do I structure a project in C? Which that might be the same kind of question,
yeah,
right?
It sounds like a similar
question. Like a low level life versus Rails, you know, Rails or, you know, any of the more modern. You know, J2EE, they've all got a lot of opinions. Now,
yes.
This is how you structure a Rails project. Please try to work with me, not against me.
Yes.
Same thing with, you know, Java Enterprise, and you know, .NET, right? They come with, boom, you know, here's a default standard project configuration and folder structure. So I guess is F Sharp more like C?
Yeah, and then there's like a whole aftermarket kind of cottage industry of all sorts of really cool C libraries you can put together that, you know, thousands of lines of code that are already there in place for you. See, the reason I weighed in on this was not because I wanted him to program one way or the other. Right? But it was because he said he was learning, and he was from the C-sharp world, and I anticipated the discussion to be something like, well, I use blah, 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 and when you use blah, 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 you do blah, 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 and nothing wrong, right. Blah, 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 may be great, I don't give a shit, right? But my question was, if you're really trying to learn, you should be able to think past, okay, well, this solution is very simple, I have this array of tools I can now use. That's probably a better spot to be learning from. Now, if you were in a corporate environment, it might be a different answer. Maybe you're in a corporate environment, you're all going to do web programming using the web blah, blah, blah tool. Cool beans. That's fine. That's fine with me. But to me, that's kind of that's not learning in the same fashion he was asking the question. It just sounded like I like chocolate ice cream discussion. It was like, okay, instead of who likes chocolate ice cream? Sure, it's great ice cream. Let's talk about whether or not you should be eating ice cream, because you may be a little pudgy right now. You're not just... That may be a better thing to be talking about. People, I mean, goddamn. My biggest problem moving to a functional world was actually carrying too much OO framework with me that I could use later, but I didn't need right away.
I wouldn't doubt it, yeah.
Because it's a different way of solving problems. I would come up with an entity at the end of the problem domain. What you end up doing, John, you end up doing analysis while you're coding. Because what you're doing is you're actually doing your use cases or user stories. Those are your functions. So as you're writing the function, the testable function, you're actually executing the feature that you would normally do in like a whiteboard exercise or whatever else. So you're growing that object model as you go through writing your code, which means you can't start with a folder structure because you know what the hell the folders are going to be.
Interesting. Okay.
And I have an example from the book with I did a module blocking system in JavaScript, and it ended up being more powerful than WordPress, about 304 lines of code, done with the whole thing, walk away. Good stuff here.
Yeah, I did like the, that's my favorite quote from my dad, you know, the old measure twice, cut once.
Yes. Well, here's the example. Okay, guys, we're going to build this jigsaw puzzle. And it's got a cow playing a banjo in the field. Okay, so here's the final picture, guys. You can see there's like a picture of a blurry box. Here's the final picture. It attaches a 14-page addendum to what all our coding rules and structures are. You know, I'll be back next week. Tell me, you know, how you're doing. So it's like the most important part of this whole picture is, what does the damn cow look like playing the banjo? Right? Everything else is just to prevent you from getting there. He seemed like he was kind of asking that question, like, okay, give me the 14-page handout. It's like, no, show me the cow with the banjo, dude.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Well, let me do my goodbye thing here. Hang on.
Okay.
You have lost yet another hour of your precious time hanging out with us on Nerd Roundup, and we're really happy you dropped by today. It's been a wonderful hour. We've discussed all sorts of really cool stuff. If you fly 777s, please spend next Nerd Roundup learning how to work your stupid computer instead of watching us.